Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I don't think the public really appreciates how much effort is being initiated and driven into different ways to improve our healthcare system in the United States. I would have to say that this was initiated before the Accountable Care Act, but it largely has been initiated and driven by that. However, after that came the bipartisan Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act of 2015, sometimes known as MACRA, and that is really driving Medicare to look at new ways to link payment to providers, really based more on value than on a fee-for-service basis. Slowly, other payers are adopting strategies that look a lot like this, and the overarching hope is that access, quality, and cost in the United States for healthcare can be improved. On this edition of Line One, we're going to discuss what changes are in store with Medicaid reform and expansion in Alaska, and our guest is Department of Health and Social Services Healthcare Policy Advisor Monique Martin. Monique, welcome, and thanks for doing this.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
If you have questions or comments during the next hour or so, here's how you can get in touch with us. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And line one, you have to spell out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all at one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. So another perception I have is that there's confusion about Medicare and Medicaid. And so maybe a reasonable place to start is if you could maybe just give us an overview of those programs and what's the difference?
Sure. I think that's a confusion that comes up a lot with folks is Medicaid and Medicare. What are the differences? Who's served? And both programs were actually signed into law by President Johnson back in 1965. And really how we kind of describe them is Medicare is care that's provided to those that are 65 years of age or older. Or maybe have a qualifying disability or medical condition, like end-stage renal disease is an example. It's Medicare is federally authorized. It's federally offered, operated, and therefore it's federally paid 100%. Medicaid is more income-based. Historically, the Medicaid program has covered women and children. The Medicaid program is federally authorized, but it's operated by the state. Therefore, the state pays some and the feds pay some. The match from the federal government varies by state to state, but in Alaska, for the Medicaid program, it varies if it's kids, but typically for adults, it's about 50% feds and 50% is paid by the state. The CHIP program, Children's Health Insurance Program, you mentioned earlier, has a higher match. But Medicaid, typically 50-50 between the state and feds.
And CHIP is part of the Medicaid program, has nothing to do. So one big difference is the feds are paying for all of the Medicare, and the Medicaid is some differences in how much between the state and the feds, and then with the expansion, that is different in some way. So part of Medicaid expansion is to get more people that had no health insurance some kind of health care. And the feds sweetened the pie, it seems like to me, by at least agreeing to pay for some of that.
Right.
Or more of that, I should say.
Definitely. So Medicaid expansion came about in the Affordable Care Act. And there was sort of a sweetening of the pie with an enhanced federal match. So for the first 3 years of Medicaid expansion, it was a firm 3 years. It wasn't a rolling 3 years. It started in 2014. It was available to states. And the federal government would pay 100% of the cost for the first 3 years. And then it drops to 95% starting in 2017 and then transitions to in 2020. The feds will pay 90%. The state pays 10, and that continues as long as a state has Medicaid expansion.
To get back to the differences a little bit, so Medicare takes care of those individuals over 65 with some others thrown in, And so that left nothing to cover women who may have problems or children who weren't working at all. And so Medicaid was designed to meet those needs. Plus, there's some other things thrown in that. But basically, that's the big difference.
Right, exactly.
And expansion, was I correct in saying that was to also go ahead and provide a little bit of ability to have some health care for those individuals who could not afford it? They may not have qualified for Medicaid in the past, but they still couldn't afford health insurance.
Correct. So in Medicaid expansion, how you qualify is based on your income. And if you earn up to 138% of the federal poverty level, you would qualify for Medicaid expansion. And how that 138% seems sort of like an odd number was picked is when they started looking at designing the Affordable Care Act, if people were covered with Medicaid up to 138% of the federal poverty level. To give you an idea, for an individual person in Alaska, we have a little bit higher federal poverty level. It's more expensive to live here, is no surprise.
Yeah, and health care is a lot more.
Exactly, right. So,
in particular.
Yeah. For a single adult, 100% of the federal poverty level is $14,840. So when the federal government, when legislators, when people were looking at how do we design Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act is 50% of the uninsured in America would be covered by Medicaid expansion if it were implemented in all 50 states. So that's where that sort of odd number of 138% came from. Mm-hmm. And it's really designed for, in Alaska, if you are an adult without a an adult without a child or a disabling condition, you couldn't qualify no matter your income. If you made $1 a year, you couldn't qualify for Medicaid in our state prior to Medicaid expansion.
I am about as apolitical as anybody can come, so I haven't really followed this, but my gestalt is that Governor Walker had a big problem, may continue to be having a big problem, just getting the Medicaid expansion approved or us beginning to use that. So what are the arguments against this is what I'm going to ask.
So I think it kind of varied. There were several different arguments. You know, as the match for the federal government transitions from 100% to 90%, some of the arguments against Medicaid expansion were, what if the federal government doesn't uphold their end of the deal to keep right. paying 90 cents of every dollar? Right. And the argument sort of against that argument against Medicaid expansion was, you know, the federal government has said, we're going to pay this. It would take an act of Congress and then agreement by the president to change the federal match for the Medicaid expansion program. Mm-hmm. There was also some confusion about what we call the myth of the cliff, which meant that by expanding Medicaid, we might inadvertently keep people from their full earning potential by kind of locking them in to not exceeding that magical right. 138% of the federal poverty level. Right. But the Affordable Care Act was designed where people could transition between those programs so that if for some reason you became ineligible for Medicaid, you got a promotion at work, you started mm-hmm. earning more money, mm-hmm. You would qualify, one, for a special enrollment period. So you could go to healthcare.gov and sign up even if you were outside the normal open enrollment period. And you would qualify then for a pretty significant subsidy to reduce your monthly payment, but also your deductible you have to meet for the year, your co-pays, that type of thing, is really based on income. And those earning different income levels qualify for different subsidies, would really reduce their out-of-pocket cost as they transition from Medicaid to then a health care plan offered on healthcare.gov.
Okay. So what's the converse is, why would the state, and I'll say Governor Walker, who wanted to push this, is my understanding, why would they want to do this then?
Why would we want to expand Medicaid right. is we had a significant number of Alaskans who didn't qualify for a plan on the Affordable Care Act if they earned less than 100% of the federal poverty level. So back to that $14,840 for a single adult. If they earn less than that without Medicaid expansion, in our state, not only did they not qualify for Medicaid, but they also did not qualify to receive one of those subsidies on healthcare.gov. So they could go to healthcare.gov, select a plan and purchase it, but they would have to pay the full cost of that healthcare premium, which, as we know, in Alaska is pretty steep. So that in a lot of cases, the healthcare premium might exceed what that person was making in a year. So there was a big portion of folks saying, we got to cover Alaskans. They're getting their care somewhere. They're probably reliant upon the emergency room, which due to the EMTALA rule, the emergency room has to provide that care. And providing a pretty steep cost to hospitals in Alaska, about $100 million a year of uncompensated care that's provided to Alaskans in our state.
Mm-hmm. And somebody has to pay that.
Somebody's got to pay
somewhere.
The bill.
It may not not be obvious where it's coming from, but
Exactly. Others might be paying more than their fair share if they have private insurance. Hospitals are making up for that. The Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association studied Medicaid expansion. Their finding was by implementing Medicaid in our state, Medicaid expansion in our state, we could save probably between $20 and $30 million a year in that uncompensated care.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that recently I heard through the media, probably, I don't think I saw the official report, that the actual costs of Medicaid expansion have been much more, or have been excessive compared to what was expected. And so two questions. One, is that true? And how is that beginning to affect how the state is looking at the expansion?
Sure. So as of July 31st, about 20,371 Alaskans have been determined eligible for Medicaid under expansion. And we have actually seen in our first year estimates, we've exceeded what the health care costs would be. We're sort of, as we're really nearing the one-year anniversary of Medicaid expansion coming up, we're starting to look at all the data that's come in. Where are the savings been achieved? So it has exceeded, and we're diving into those numbers now, so we'll have more information on that. Other states have found that this is a population that has gone without health care coverage because maybe they're low-income adults, mm-hmm. don't have children, don't qualify for another program. So they've got some pent-up health issues, and they're seeking out a primary care provider. They're getting their blood screened. They're getting, you know, getting all those things that they've just had to put off because they've had a lack of health care. So we'll be looking at that very closely as we reach that one-year anniversary of Medicaid expansion.
So we're very early into this in this state and in most states. Is that true? It's not that we're a heck of a lot different, and not all states have elected to take the Medicare expansion.
Medicaid expansion. See, we're back to that confusion.
Medicaid expansion. Right.
Yeah, you know, I think some states went on January 1st, 2014, they jumped right in both feet to Medicaid expansion. Other states have wanted to wait to see how it went, let those front runners out there kind of learn the lessons and then implement a program that would work for them. And so I think there's still some lessons being learned. A lot of states that implemented Medicaid expansion kind of on the first day it was available saw that spike in the first year and saw maybe some higher health care costs than they were anticipating because of that pent-up demand, and then it's flattened out over the next 2 years. I think that was why it was important for us to implement expansion, because we'll still get 100% of those federal funds for Medicaid expansion through the end of this calendar year.
So at least one of the arguments against it was this kind of bait and switch, or the government was going to get the state in and then withdraw their subsidy over time. That's not happened.
No, that has not happened.
But costs have exceeded what actuarially was expected, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Or maybe fortunately. depends on how you look at it. If people really had the need for health care, then I think that's probably money well spent.
Exactly. I think we're right on in terms of numbers. We're a little bit over. We anticipated 20,066 Alaskans would enroll in year one. We're about 1% over that right now. The makeup of the Medicaid expansion population we thought would be different than our traditional Medicaid program, which is typically in our traditional program, women and children. Medicaid expansion we thought would be a younger population and mostly male, and that is really holding true to the estimates that we found in the Healthy Alaska plan. So we are over costs a little bit, but as we dive into those numbers, we'll know more, but it's not a panic as of yet as far as we're really exceeding numbers. We think that we're probably right on, and let's have folks get that health care that they need.
Let me remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection. My guest today is Monique Martin. She's a healthcare policy advisor for the Department of Health and Social Services. And we're really talking about Medicaid expansion, which is pretty much what we've talked about to this point. And then probably a large portion of the rest of the show will be on reform. There's two separate issues. I thought it would be useful to understand the expansion, and then we'll be talking about reform. If you've got questions or comments, there's a couple ways to get a hold of us in the next now 45 minutes that we'll be here. Our local number is 550-8433. Let me do it again, 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And then we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So in a big sense, Monique, one of our problems in this country is a large percentage of people who do not have access to health care. And we're all paying for that in one way or the other. So the federal government has said, let's help some of those in various and sundry ways, one of which is this Medicaid expansion, which is all gets back to the Affordable Care Act in various ways. It's interesting to me that the MACRA legislation was really bipartisan, is my understanding, compared to everybody's complaint about the Obama plan, or a lot of people's concerns about that. So that the change towards paying for value seems to have broader support than some of the other aspects of the Accountable Care Act. I always say the Affordable Care Act for some reason. The Accountable Care Act.
Yeah, you know, I think we're seeing more and more programs move from fee-for-service. Definitely in Medicare, they're definitely moving towards paying for value. And I think during the stakeholder process that we went through related to the Medicaid Expansion and Redesign Technical Assistance Contract, that you see a lot of those recommendations were included in Senate Bill 74 that's really driving our Medicaid reform efforts. We heard from stakeholders sort of loud and clear that we need to move towards a value-based payment model. We're really one of the last remaining states that's strictly fee-for-service. And really, that's, you know, you perform a service, you get paid for it. You perform a service, you get paid for it. And unfortunately, that may be rewarding volume-based versus really focusing in on, currently I'm struggling with allergies and I've got new medicine, and maybe it's bronchitis or maybe it's allergies, but my doctor keeps getting paid for my visits, or are they getting paid for, does Monique have allergies or does Monique have bronchitis, and trying to get it addressed?
Let's focus on that just a second, because it's another thing I think the listeners really have to understand, because basically our whole free enterprise system is based on a fee-for-service model. And what happens in medicine, and you're going to correct me now, all right, I'm not trying to be the authority, but I am on the medicine aspect of things. If I see you for your allergies and I do X and you don't get better and you come back and see me again and I do Y and you don't get better, it's not any sweat off my back. I'm making money each time I see you. So that there is no incentive to look for efficiencies and value and corrections in the system. But I want to quickly point out that's true in law. That's true when you go to the grocery store.
Right.
It's everywhere. But what's different about healthcare, it's eaten up 17% right now of our gross national product. And what we spend on healthcare, we can't spend on education, infrastructure, and everything else. Mm-hmm. So that's, in a sense, what's driving a lot of this change. And it's a big change. I mean, I think it makes sense. But everything else we do is driven on, if I was going to start a business, one of the things I remember reading somewhere and is that you want to just meet the public's need. Okay. And you provide something they need. But in healthcare, we've been, in a sense, kind of doing that, but there's no incentive for me to be more cost efficient. Now we're going to move to a system where I have more skin in the game, so to speak. I'm not going to get paid if I'm not doing the right thing. I'm not going to get paid if I don't show value for what I'm doing. But there's still this other arching concept in medicine is we're moving towards more personalization and meeting what the patient needs or wants, so to speak. And it, in a sense, kind of is two things driving it at opposite in opposite ways. And have you, as part of the Medicaid reform, have you guys had that idea broached to you, and how are you thinking about it?
I think when we heard from stakeholders through our initial process, we see a lot more payers moving to sort of this value versus volume. And one of the things we heard is, you know, we can definitely improve health outcomes, we can definitely reduce costs, but as a healthcare provider, you know, they're going to spend money to make less money. So where is the funding or the incentive, if there's payments for providers who meet certain goals in health outcomes, or is there a per member per month fee to provide case management services so that a provider's office could have someone that reaches out to Monique to make sure she's taking her allergy medicine every day, to make sure that she went in and got her blood test before she comes back in to see the provider so that there's results to read, to make sure that I get my mammography whenever I'm supposed to make sure I get my colonoscopy whenever I'm supposed to, who's reviewing my family history to make sure I'm getting all those tests on the right schedule based on my family history and my health issues. And we heard from providers that that is something we can do, but we're not getting paid to provide those services. And it's a lot of work to make sure that we're working with the patient to make sure we're meeting all those schedules and tests and things that help us find issues before they become a catastrophic health issue. Mm-hmm. So we talked
And which ones are cost effective in the first place?
Exactly.
And then from whose point of view is kind of also what I'm driving at. It, from the patient's point of view, what may be cost effective or ideally suited may not be the right thing from the healthcare system's point of view.
Right.
Anyway, I'll let you continue.
Yeah, and I think that those are good points because people wanted to say, you know, we want to look at evidence-based models, what really has been shown to work to improve health outcomes. And that's a really important part is not what I think I need as a patient, but what is evidence showing will really work for me based on my health condition and my family health history and those types of things. Mm-hmm.
All right, so let me back up a little bit. I got on my little high horse, had to get my 10 cents in here, and I want to apologize. So we talked about Medicaid expansion, and at the same time, the state of Alaska said we need to reform Medicaid. So let's do both at the same time. Is that correct? Is that what kind of happened?
Well, you know, I think there's this confusion about that reform is something we've just ignored. And I think at the Department of Health and Social Services, even prior to the current administration, there's been reform efforts. With a program this large, you really need to be looking at ways to find efficiency and improvements. Healthcare is changing daily, if not minute by minute. So there's been healthcare reform efforts at the department looking at case management services for maybe those who overutilize the emergency room because they just don't know where to access care or how to access it appropriately, whether it's controls on pharmacy or increased fraud and abuse prevention measures. We've really looked at those, but so it's not new to the department. I think something of this scale, this is a pretty big overarching reform that we're going to be taking on as part of the efforts outlined in Senate Bill 74.
All right. So let me ask you then, how did this administration or whoever's driving this reform, I'm going to in quotes, how'd you go about that?
So first came up, the department was talking with one of our really important partners, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And they said, we agree, reform is important. So they funded a contract, which was ultimately awarded to a local firm, Agnew Beck, who subcontracted with Health Management Associates for some of the national policy expertise, and an actuarial firm, Milliman. And that contract, we went through, we looked at, we had webinars and we had some key partner meetings, and we looked at reform. What is it going to be in Alaska? And we heard quite a few things. Ultimately, then during the legislative session, we sort of merged together the governor's bill on reform and Senator Kelly's Senate Bill 74, and kind of took the best of both of those bills and created through a mashup process what you see in ultimately Senate Bill 74, which was signed into law.
If I were to say, what's the primary goal of the Medicaid reform, you would answer?
I think I would answer, if you look on the front page of the Medicaid Expansion and Redesign Technical Assistance contract, you'll see four things. And of course, with any sort of healthcare reform, they tend to closely match the triple aim. But on the front of the Agnew Beck report, you'll see our four goals are to improve health, optimize access, which I think optimize is a key. It's not increasing access. We want to make sure that people are getting the appropriate care from the appropriate provider. Increase value and contain costs.
Outside of Alaska, it appears to me, again, as a non-economist who has a special interest in a belief that we need to do something to control our health care costs, that this is being done in certain frameworks. There is the patient-centered medical home approach, which many Blue Cross organizations have shown, in my understanding, fairly substantial at decreasing costs. We're beginning to see Medicare reimbursed for value, which again now makes the onus on the provider to be more cost effective in how they're handling every patient every day. Is, I guess what I'm getting at is this working? Do we have evidence to date, early, I know, that we're having some success?
Well, I think some of these reform efforts are going to take some time. So we have definitely lessons learned from other states that we can look at and say, you know, what worked in Oregon or what worked in Oklahoma or Vermont, we can learn some lessons from that. But we might need to take into special consideration things that make Alaska a little bit different. If you look at just the sheer size of our state with such a small population, we have some real specific things we need to consider differently than other states. No matter how much they might say they have a rural area, mm-hmm. Nothing compares to our rural. So we have things that have worked in other states, things states have done that haven't worked so well. We're right now in our process, some reforms are already underway. There were some privatization studies that were outlined. Those contracts have been awarded. We have our 16 work groups sort of associated with the big pieces of Senate Bill 74 to make the reform work happen. And these will kind of continue to happen over a really quick timeline or over 2 or 3 years to bring them to fruition.
I want to continue along this line, but we typically take a break here, Monique. I'm going to take about a one-minute break. I don't think I remembered to warn you that as we got together today. So our listeners that are listening to Line 1 can kind of revamp and think about what we're talking about. And let me remind everyone, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Again, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and then we'll continue the discussion of Medicaid expansion and reform with Monique Martin. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Monique Martin. Monique is a healthcare policy advisor for the Department of Health and Social Services. If you have questions or comments, there's a couple of ways to call us, and we'll be here for about another 25 minutes or so. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, our local number 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening to this between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be available to answer your questions. You can always have listen to the program again if you go to alaskapublic.org. Just look up for the Line 1 link, and you can find our archive. You can listen to the program later. You can refer someone to listen to the program if you'd like to in that way as well. So we're talking now about the reform efforts, and we've mentioned earlier about the purpose of the expansion or what the expansion of Medicaid was all about. And one other thing, I want to get into a little bit more of the specifics, but in my opportunity to talk to experts about healthcare around the country, another issue has risen that I think to me is important, and I kind of want to see where the policy advisors for the state have been on this as well, and that's the idea that it turns out, as illogical as it might initially appear, that a lot of health is not necessarily related to health care. And we know that because one of the facts is we spend more in this country than almost every other country in the world, and yet our health indicators are decreasing relative to everybody else. So it's not how much money you throw at health care, which suggests something's not right there. But many people involved in looking at health and at countries that are seeming to be doing better with health of their population and spending less is that the social aspects of health care are very important. So the other thing we know about the United States is although we spend a lot more in health care, we spend less on the social aspects than other countries. Are the powers to be understand that issue? Because it suggests that just throwing or doing something about the health care system may not address the whole health issue of our population.
Right. I think that's something that we saw definitely was important for the legislature this year. And there's a specific call out in Senate Bill 74 that directs the department to assist those that are applying for Medicaid or food stamp benefits to provide referrals to community and social supports. And in talking with different legislators about this, it became pretty clear that it was more than just here's a piece of paper with, you know, some job training programs or, you know, where you can get back to school supplies for your child if you can't afford them. It was really clear that it was much more than that, that we really need to be assisting people and trying to help them connect with more services. I think another one that's a little less direct, but you can see it in Senate Bill 74, is health home implementation. And health homes really look at allowing providers to do something a little differently. You focus on someone with a behavioral health need, but also a chronic health condition. And then you make sure that they have what they need. The provider works with that. And one of the examples we heard from other states is an elderly woman ended up in the emergency room numerous times when it got below above 90 degrees. Might be different in Alaska. We might need a heater. But but they said that when the temperatures rose, this elderly woman ended up in the emergency room. So with the health home, they were able to get additional funding. They went to her home and found out she doesn't have an air conditioning unit. And, you know, by purchasing an AC for her to put in her window, kept the temperatures down. And in one avoided emergency room visit, they paid for that air conditioning unit. And it became very obvious that maybe it's not, as you mentioned, the healthcare delivery every time. It's some of those things are what are happening in this person's home or in their work life. Have they been laid off or their hours reduced? What are the other issues that are maybe making it hard for them to find the time to focus on their healthcare needs?
We've had a couple of calls come in, and I want to get to them, and I'll ask them to hang on. But I want to, while we're on this, expand on some specifics. You mentioned the overriding goals were in improve health and optimize access, not just access, but more effective access or optimize how we're using healthcare, increase value, and decrease cost. What are some of the specifics? You just mentioned the home health move where there's a little bit more overarching look even into the social aspects of the patients that they're seeing.
Right. There's the health homes. I think one of the big ones for us in Alaska that has the opportunity to really create some exciting innovation for us is the coordinated care demonstration projects. And we spent a lot of time during the stakeholder process and even during the legislative session talking about different healthcare delivery models or innovative payment models that might work for us in Alaska. And what we realized is that lots of people have great ideas, and it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all for us. What works in Anchorage might not work on the Kenai Peninsula and might not work on the North Slope. So the legislature came up with this demonstration project where we will have to release an RFP by the end of this year and request people, providers, insurance companies, whoever might be out there, to submit proposals to the state to say, how do we think that they can do it better down on the Kenai or out in the valley, wherever it might be. We really want to let the providers drive what they think are the innovations for their area that will work best.
And that's similar to what Medicare is doing with their innovation center. They're using accountable care organizations and value-based payment and so forth. So it's a similar approach. It's throw some things out there and let's see how people want to do it and or how they're going to do it differently. What are your outcomes here? Are you looking just at cost? How do you evaluate these programs?
Right. And I think we'll probably be asking people for feedback on what's the best way to measure because if someone says we're going to take on the care and we're going to save you money and they just reduce the services that are available, sure, they can maybe reduce healthcare costs, but they're not creating a healthier Alaska population. So we'll probably look at things like costs, but also what are the health outcomes that they're seeing. So I think we really want to let the people submitting proposals, the organizations submitting proposals, drive what they see as how they will deliver care, how they will measure performance, how will this impact costs, is really let the proposer sort of develop all of that so that they can really show the success of their program or where there's area for improvements.
A lot of the changes, I want to get to our callers, but a lot of the changes can take years and years to see benefit. If you're going to address mental health or emotional health, which has a big impact on healthcare costs, incidentally, it may take years to demonstrate that.
Absolutely.
So, and I see if I was in Medicaid's state of Alaska Medicaid shoes, I'd say, yeah, we got to demonstrate we can save some money really quick. So these programs that may pay off and I'm using the word may, pay off better in the long term in big money, are not going to get looked at very seriously because we can't demonstrate that they're going to be cost effective.
We're kind of looking at reform in, I think, two parts at least. Is one, you know, you look at our budget challenges we're facing in Alaska, is we got to find some quick wins. And I think they're real quick wins, right?
Right.
You know, the department's budget was reduced by 8%, about $94 million for the current fiscal year. And we are trying to find ways to save money, refinance, whatever it might be, to really reduce the impact to the Alaskans that rely on those programs to heat their home, feed their children, or get the health care that they need. And we're looking at some quick wins with the tribal claiming policy, working with our tribal partners to increase the federal match, where we anticipate saving $32 million in this current fiscal year as a direct result to that policy. So we got to find some quick wins. Behavioral health, like you mentioned, that's a big one for us and our reform efforts. It's going to take some time, but we can get there. We just need to find some quick wins while we work on those others.
Okay. All right. Let's get some thoughts and comments for some others and answer a few phone calls. Jeff, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. My question just related to finding these efficiencies, not through a contractual basis with Agnew Beck, for example, but mainly is there not an arm of the state department that the department in the state that could provide these services?
If I'm understanding correctly, I think what we're looking at are providers that are out there serving Medicaid recipients every day. What are some of their ideas? And I think we definitely have at the state some ideas of, you know, different ways to reform the Medicaid program. But I think who better to tell us, you know, some of the opportunities for improvements from those that are, one, either receiving or a Medicaid beneficiary or are providers that are providing that service, as well as, you know, there's a lot to be learned from what succeeded or failed, I think, in other states as well.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call, Jeff.
Thank you.
All right. Nancy, you're on line one.
Yes, thanks for having me on the call. Monique, I think I met you in Juneau. I was part of a group of school nurses that were down there interviewing you and the commissioner, and I'd like to thank you for sticking it out down there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. There's a lot of fun to be had in Juneau and Anchorage with Medicaid reform these days, so it's keeping me busy.
Indeed. Wanted to ask you, too, a couple of questions about Denali Kid Care versus Medicaid. As you know, most school nurses deal with giving information to both the kids and parents about Denali Kid Care, how to sign up, how to expedite, and so forth. I know that Denali Kid Care is Medicaid, but it has its own office and its own people. So what are the differences, and how do you help schools and kids sign up for Denali Kid Care and expedite so that they don't have to wait and wait and wait?
Right. So I will freely admit that Denali Kid Care and that process with schools is not my strong suit. But, I will say that that's ensuring that kids, especially folks or pregnant women, so that we give future Alaskans the best start possible. We have some emergent phone lines, so if people need to get enrolled in health care, they can get it as a pregnant woman, get them sort of at the top of the list so that they're getting the prenatal care that they need. If we have kids that have health issues and they need medicine, they have prescriptions that they need, we have an emergent phone line for them to sort of also jump to the top of the list. And then just spreading the word, too, about the availability of the program during registration for school. We have folks out there. And then working with our partners, our navigator organizations, to help spread the word that these programs really are available so that people can sign up and start getting those benefits, I think, is a really important process for us in Alaska.
Thanks. The emergent phone line, is that up on your website, or how do I get that number?
It is.
I'll use it.
Yeah. My apologies for not bringing it with me, but if you go to dhss.alaska.gov, you'll get to the department's homepage and then click on the link for public assistance. And right on their homepage, you'll see the emergent phone line for getting your application processed in a more timely manner.
Thanks.
Thanks for your call, Nancy. Sharon, you're on line one.
Yes, I had a question about dealing with elders. I have a mother that is down in the state of Washington and could never conceive of bringing her up here for me to help care for her in skilled nursing, because our health care costs are just so much more higher up here, number one. And number two, there seems to be a cap at around, if you have a pension of more than $2,000, there's no way that you could, get any kind of Medicaid assistance up here, even if they're in the neighborhood of $5,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month. As they're approaching, end of life, healthcare can become very expensive. That, and just kind of a general comment as to, why is healthcare so much more expensive here? I've heard that in comparison, our hospitals 15% profit on the dollar as opposed to 5% in the lower 48. Why do we traditionally, I understand that we're far away and it takes a lot to run something from a distance, but that much of a difference, it just seems kind of like we could work on this issue a little bit better.
Yeah, I think, I think for bringing your mother to Alaska, I'd encourage you to check in with our Division of Senior and Disability Services. One of the things we look at the department sort of in an effort to reduce health care costs is if your mother could stay at home or at your home with some help from someone who comes in and provides care, personal care attendant, we really want to make sure that people are able to stay in their homes or their communities as long as their health allows, if that means a little bit more assistance, because as we look at providing a skilled nursing level of care, that, of course, is a much more institutional type care, definitely more expensive, but we really want people to be able to stay in their homes and communities. So there are some spend downs and different things related to getting assistance for that nursing level of care, and we can get you some of that information. I can provide you an email, and then it will come to me, and I'll make sure to direct it to the right person. If you email me at medicaid.redesign@alaska.gov, I'd be happy to connect you up with the right person that can talk a little bit more about some of the spend down and things associated with that care.
Okay, thank you so much.
And I think as far as the high cost of health care in Alaska, I think that different people have different ideas of maybe why that is. Definitely our geography, some of those challenges, a small population spread across a great big area makes it tough. But I think there's a lot of different theories. And, some of those things we're looking at in reform, telehealth is a big one for us in Alaska. If you live in a rural part of your state, maybe flying to Anchorage in January doesn't sound that exciting. And if you could see your specialist, a cardiologist, or primary care provider over telehealth and really ensure that if you're traveling, it's really medically necessary, that's one of the things we want to do in an effort to not only reduce costs, but make sure people are getting quality health care that they want.
Thank you.
All right. And one more thing I would say is within the last couple of years, we did interview a healthcare economist from UAA on the cost of healthcare. I have to admit, I can't remember his name, but if you look back on our archives at alaskapublic.org on line one, you could find a good discussion on this issue. And I'm sure if you put in healthcare costs in your browser, you can come up with some of the reports that UAA has put out on our costs up here. So thanks for your call again. Ron, you're on line one?
Yeah. I just turned 65 this month, and so I've joined everybody into Medicare, and because of that, my former insurance is now my secondary insurer, and Medicare is now my first primary insurer, and I just received my first bill for Medicare, about $500, but unfortunately, I have lost all of my doctors, which don't except Medicare. And I think it's kind of strange that I would like to pay them out of pocket, but I can't do that because we both break the law. And I'm wondering if there's anything on the horizon that's going to change that. Now, I know this goes back to 1975, and But there must, since we're talking about reform, and I know this, you guys are really talking about Medicaid, but this is kind of part of it, and part of the problem with finding doctors in Alaska. I know there's a doctor that I've gone to before, which he certainly looks at Medicare, but he's got a factory going on there, and every single time I would see a bill from him, it's just so expensive and so high, I would feel guilty about using insurance for that. But I could. He takes Medicare. I could do that. I just think this is it's something else that needs to be looked at. And what do you do when you turn 65 and you lose your doctors?
You know, I think we have a great resource available to us here in Alaska. It's our Medicare Information Office. And even though Medicare, as you mentioned, is that federal program, we don't have a lot of sway over some of those regulations. Is the Medicare Information Office is set up. They have staff. They're actually part of the Department of Health and Social Services here at the state. And they really help people sort of navigate Medicare through, you know, different open enrollment periods for Medicare, finding providers, that type of thing. And they are an incredible resource. And unfortunately, I don't have their phone number with me. But if you... I'll use that same medicaid.redesign@alaska.gov. I'll be on the lookout. Those emails come to me, and I'll be happy to connect you up with the great folks at the Medicare Information Office to see if they can kind of help you navigate that system a little bit more, like right now, immediately to meet your needs. But I think, you know, the Medicare program in Alaska covers about 150,000, 160,000 lives. You know, a lot of people come on and off the program. Summer's upon us. We got lots of tourists. Maybe people are driving a bus of tourists from Seward to Anchorage. And maybe in the winter months, they come on our Medicare program. So when you're covering that many lives, we know, we hope anyway, that the reforms that we make to the Medicare program will reduce Medicaid or healthcare costs in our state, and maybe allow providers to take on more Medicare clients if it doesn't pay as well as Medicaid or private insurance. So we're hoping that as we reform our Medicaid program, it will sort of have a ripple effect through other healthcare payers throughout the state.
Yeah, I hope that's the case, because it's really hard to imagine that what the state is doing is going to have a whole lot of impact with what's going on at the federal level. And but there is that issue. It's part of that question of why things are so expensive in Alaska. Because if just on the face of it, I would say, well, okay, right now I lost my doctor, so what do I do? Well, let's see, I got a cold. I'll go to the ER.
Right.
I could go to Providence, and then that's ridiculously expensive. So
absolutely.
Then I won't do that. You know, and then, you know, just checkups and all that stuff. I mean, that becomes a really expensive way to go, and seems to be increasing the cost instead of decreasing the cost. And anyway, that's my 2 cents, and probably my pitch for a single payer system.
Well, Ron, you're right, and one of our problems is we have an extremely complex, highly costly, high cost administration system compared to other countries. And one possible answer is the single payer. Politically, it's not going to go anywhere. I can tell you, but it would fix some problems. It may make other problems. So, thanks for your call.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
What's the timeline here? I've got a medical administrator, office administrator at home, and we're looking at a lot of these things that Medicaid wants to do. We're doing some of the things already. We don't get any reimbursement for some of the extra costs. So she wants me to know, ask you, when's all this going to happen? What do you foresee?
Sure. So some of these reforms are happening now. So we have some that were outlined in 74, some Senate Bill 74, some of the reform efforts that the legislature directed the department to look at, privatizing some services. The contracts have been awarded and the studies are underway. Right now, where we're at in the process is, as we talked about, behavioral health reform in our state's probably a really big undertaking. That we have created sort of a patchwork quilt, and our providers are doing the best to navigate the system that the department has created. And we've created 6 teams to look at how we redesign our behavioral health system to set up not only providers, but the Alaskans they serve for success. So some of these are reforms that are going to take some time, and others will be ones that we're able to implement. The tribal claiming policy I mentioned has an opportunity to save us some significant dollars. We anticipate $32 million in savings this fiscal year. And some are just going to take a little bit of time, so they're kind of all over the map. But really what I encourage people do to sort of stay up on the time frames, and we'll be publishing more time frames so people can kind of watch our progress as we go on the Healthy Alaska page. So if you go to dhss.alaska.gov and you look for the Healthy Alaska Plan logo, if you click on that, you'll be able to see some of our progress and even go back and look at some of the stuff that ended up with some of the reforms recommended that were included in Senate Bill 74.
Yeah, and those links are on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can go to line one and you can get the same links to get to a lot of the information that we've discussed today. We're really already into our last just 2 minutes or so, and I think this would be a logical time for me to do my usual, let's stop and analyze and think about what's important for listeners to take away from today's program. So I'll give you a little bit more than the usual minute I give people, and if it takes you less time, I'll come up with another question.
Deal. So I think the two takeaways I would say for, since we've talked about expansion and reform, is for expansion is I encourage people to apply. Because we didn't have expansion on January 1st, 2014, we have quite a few Alaskans that heard they don't qualify for Medicaid, and they simply made too little money to qualify for a subsidy to help them purchase healthcare coverage on healthcare.gov. So even if you're an Alaskan out there and you go, well, none of these programs are for me, I heard no twice, I really encourage them to come back to either go to healthcare.gov, go to getcoveredalaska.org, and you can find a navigator or an assister in your local community to help you to see if you qualify for any programs. And for reform, I would encourage people to stay tuned, keep watching. We are doing email updates. If you go to how about this to make it easy on folks? If you're interested in keeping up with reform, email me at medicaid.redesign@alaska.gov, and I'll email you how you can sign up for our listserv to get email updates on all the reform efforts that are underway at the state.
Wow. A very, very quick hour. I really appreciate the time and effort that you put into this. Plus, it's impressive that what's going on under everybody's visual screen that the state is trying to address an extremely complex problem. One of the thoughts I had when I looked up who you were and where you came from and Valerie is you both came from the Native Medical Center, where everybody's under the same contract, everybody's getting paid, and it's much easier to herd those cats in that situation than ours. So thanks very much for your time, Wendy. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you so much.
If you want to continue the discussion on expansion and reform of Medicaid in Alaska, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org, where you can also find our archives. It's been estimated that about $245 billion a year is spent on diabetes in the United States. It's about the same amount spent on workplace injuries and illnesses, both of which are highly preventable to a large degree. Next week, we'll talk about the state of Alaska's diabetes prevention programs. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a good day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.